Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone Podcast. Today, we bring you the fourth episode of our Top 100 Composers series, this time going over composers 31 through 40 of our average list. So if you haven't checked out our previous three episodes, be sure to check those out. We do one of these each month. It's kind of a futile attempt to rank some of our favorite composers. We both came up with a top 100 list that we averaged together to make this kind of super average 100 composers list. But before we get into that, let's guess that lick.
Guess that lick or don't there's no prize.
Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each one of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-host will have three listens to Guess That Lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here is the scoring breakdown. Piece, movement, composer, time period, and genre are all each worth 1 point for a total of five. And last week, Fernando guessed Dvorak's Eighth Symphony, the first movement. And then today, Fernando has a lick for me to guess, and I hope that he went easy on me.
Well, we'll see what happens. It was a struggle to find a good recording, so we'll see how I did finding a recording, and I think you'll be able to figure out just at least a few of these elements.
Okay, well, that's not exactly encouraging, but but I'm excited. I'm excited to figure out what this is. All right, well, I'm ready to go if you are.
All right, let's take a listen. Right, that was our first listen. Seems like you've got a couple guesses in your head.
Well, I think that my time in Austria the last two summers has served me well on this one. So definitely have pinned down that nationality. That is definitely Mozart. Let's see. So I got the composer. So the time period with a classical composer, genre, a theme and variations.
Yep.
It's 12 variations on the theme that would famously become that Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But right. let's take another listen, because this is a tricky excerpt, because there's some really modern sounding stuff here at the beginning. Let's listen again.
That was the second listen. Some interesting harmony there at the beginning.
Absolutely, yeah. This really brings me back to my trips in Austria the last two summers, and listening to this on the train on the way back from Salzburg. Man, what a just gorgeous melody. It's his 12 variations on that theme that would become Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, for sure. The variation, that's a little bit trickier, because at the 12, I'd say maybe this fits around 5, maybe? Yeah, I think I'll go with 5 for the variation. The composer is Mozart, time period classical, and the genre is a piano theme and variations. How did I do?
Well, it is not the 5th variation. All the other stuff is correct.
Man.
The piece is his 12 variations in C on A Vous Dirige Maman, and it is actually the 11th variation.
What?
The 11th.
It's really that late?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Surprising that slow of a movement would be so late. But I guess that's where he kept his little harmonic secret.
Yeah, well, he knew that people weren't going to attempt that for another 200 years, so.
It sounds like it. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
It's really an interesting chord right there towards the beginning.
If I was not so familiar with that, and we had not talked about that piece, I feel like we've talked about this piece a few times, then that would have been really tough, because that beginning does not sound classical. Then it sounds a little bit more classical.
Right.
But that beginning right there, that's tough.
Yeah.
So that was a really good one. I guess I came away with 4 points.
Four, yeah.
For today, looking a little bit similar to last month. So Fernando is in the lead with 5 points currently, and then I'm just behind him with 4. Man, yeah, I'll have to bring a good one for you next week, see if I can keep you on your toes.
Oh, yeah. It always keeps me on my toes. I have to logic my way through it, usually.
Well, you did a great job last week with the Dvorak, so that was great. Well, we hope you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to today's topic. Welcome to our fourth edition of Top 100 Composers. This has been a really fun series for us where we take our two average lists of top 100 composers and we combine it into this one big mega list between our two tastes. And you'll see today that there's a lot of alignment between kind of some of the ones that we picked. And also, there's some big discrepancies as well, shows our own tastes, I guess. So it's a little bit of a window into what we listen to week after week. So now we're kind of getting to the point where maybe some of these composers aren't necessarily have been our favorites before, but this is a really unique group that I think that in the process of researching for this, I think we've discovered a lot of stuff that's new that we really like about these composers, and maybe they can rise a little bit in our frequency of listening after this week. And there's one or two of these here that are a little bit higher on your list than they are mine, but I will say that this one's a little bit more dominated by some of my higher picks.
Yeah, and it's funny too that even though some of them are lower on my list, I still like them a lot.
Great if you can have a composer that's ranked in like the 60s or 70s on your list and it's like, wow, I love this music,
right?
And I think that that's the case for some of these, and I think that's a good segue into this first composer here. This is one we've discussed on the podcast before. Georges Bizet, ranked number 21 on my list and 53 on Fernando's. And we had a whole episode on this, and we both talked about how great Bizet is at writing melodies and really, really catchy tunes. He's a French Romantic composer, lived from 1838 to 1875. For me, like I just said, he's just a master of melody. My favorite examples are his Symphony in C, Roma, the music from his famous opera, Carmen, of course. While the whole of Bizet's output is not as familiar to me, I think that these works alone more than earn him a high spot on my list.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that. I mean, I completely agree with all of that, but I do think that his output is limited, and that's why you only know just a few works of his.
Right, yeah.
Because there isn't a lot of orchestral music or just a lot of music in general by Bizet that is still around and being recorded.
And that's what makes this list so impossible. One, art is so subjective and really shouldn't be ranked in that kind of way. But when a composer just moves you so much and it might just be one piece, how do you categorize that against the composer that maybe has a lot of works that have affected you in a decent sense, but not as profoundly maybe as Bizet, where I listed 3 works that are just so great and so gorgeous and affect me so profoundly, versus maybe another composer that has a little bit more of output. It's an interesting topic, and we'll keep discussing that as we go through this.
Right. Just a few more things for me that I like about Bizet. I just really like, he talked about his melodic writing. I really appreciate that too, and I think it gives a very specific character and style to each piece,
right,
as necessary, and I think that that's really great. It is the driving force of his music, I think.
Absolutely.
Most of the time.
Yeah, I think that that is a really, really great description there. Well, rather than talking about it more, let's listen. This is his famous opera, Carmen. This is the entr'acte from Act 4. Let's take a listen.
Thank you. That was the entr'acte from Act 4 of Carmen by Bizet. A perfect example of the melody and just beauty of Bizet's music.
Absolutely. And I think fundamentally, it's just so strong because it starts with that great motif with the full orchestra, but then it goes down to just that bare essentials, just the accompaniment with the pizzicato, and wow, just from that fundamental point, it's so strong, and then you start to layer stuff on top, and it just gets better and better.
Absolutely. Let's get into some facts about Bizet to kind of help us understand the context of him as a composer.
Right, so he enrolled in the Paris Conservatory at age 9. He won the Prix de Rome for a musical composition in 1857, which we've talked about numerous times on the show before, and that was an award given at the Paris Conservatory for, in this case specifically, for a musical composition. And a couple of composers were in the running for it, including César Franck and Maurice Ravel, Fauré as well. Definitely something we'll talk about a lot on the show. And it's interesting, not a lot of people know this, that a lot of Bizet's income actually came from arranging works by the big French composers at the time, like Gounod. And it's funny because he's way more famous than Gounod in retrospect. So that's interesting. And another cool fact, his Symphony in C, which we talked about earlier, is his earliest work that he wrote that is still performed today. However, it was not actually performed until 1935. It was written many, many years before that when Bizet was just 17. And this was a work that was showed some of his influence from Gounod, who was a big inspiration for Bizet. Unfortunately, Bizet passed away at age 36. And despite this, he gave us some of the greatest French romantic music. And I think that absolutely earns him a spot on this list.
Every time I listen to Bizet's music, I am urged to move him up a little bit higher, but I don't know, it's that output that keeps him just a little bit lower generally on my list. I mean, still in the 50s, so that's not too bad, but, and it's especially the Symphony in C, too, that one, even though he wrote it at 17, that always blows my mind. It's so good, I really enjoy that one a lot.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We've talked about that one pretty extensively, and we had a whole episode on Bizet's Roma, which is considered to be his second symphony, though that is disputed, so that one is also really worth a listen as well. Well, with that being said, we've talked about Bizet before on the show. Let's move on to another great composer. This is Antonin Dvorak, and ranked number 10 on my list, and this might be our biggest gap so far, number 68 on Fernando's. Yet, this is still a composer that you really, really enjoy.
Yeah, and another one, very melody-driven music, and another one that I guess doesn't come into my rotation a lot, but
yeah,
is one that I really do appreciate and just has really beautiful music. Obviously, Dvorak is Czech, and so he's influenced by the folk music from that area. He has very diverse output in instrumental and choral genres, which I really appreciate. Sometimes when I get in the mood for choral music, I can switch over and still be listening to Dvorak. I just have for me, Dvorak doesn't get romantic enough, maybe, but it could just be what I'm listening to. I know I've heard some examples that you've shown me that prove that wrong already. So,
right.
So yeah, it's just a case of not coming up in my rotation too often.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to sell you on a few more of these symphonies by Dvorak in particular. To give you a little bit of context, Dvorak is a Czech romantic composer, born in 1841, passed away in 1904. Dvorak, to me, has just such an extensive output of quality that I'm still discovering today. Fun fact about me, my first ever experience performing a symphony was Dvorak's Eighth Symphony, and that's taken its place among my favorite symphonies for that reason, as well as it just being a really unique one in terms of romantic symphonies. And in addition, I'm a huge fan as well of his other symphonies, 6 and 7 and 9 in particular. 9 is really, really frequently performed, the New World Symphony. And I also am a huge fan of his string quartets and Slavonic dances. And his opera, Rasulka, is also really, really worth checking out. You would love his piano concerto too.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to listen to that. I have not heard it before, so that'll be a really good one to add for this week.
Absolutely, yeah. And then 7 in particular too, I think you'd really enjoy. But I'm going to, this is a little bit selfish of me, but I do want to play an excerpt for you guys from his 8th symphony, my personal favorite. This is the second movement, the Adagio. Let's take a listen. That was Dvorak's Symphony No. 8, the second movement, Adagio. What a great excerpt from this piece. It's so, so gorgeous. And just like with Bizet, the foundation of this piece is just so strong. And you have the ostinato that starts, and then you just layer on these gorgeous melodies and the flutes and the strings. I cannot get enough of this.
Yeah, I mean, this one might have swayed me already. It's quite dramatic, and
yeah,
really,
there's that part with the trumpet that's really dramatic.
Yeah, that part got me for sure, and it's a nice one. It's a really good one, so you better believe I'll be listening to Dvorak 8 for the rest of the week.
Yeah, you should be definitely putting this one in your rotation. And I will touch upon that point that you mentioned earlier. I think that Dvorak is a little bit more conservative in some aspects. But unlike a composer in the Romantic period like Mendelssohn or Camille Saint-Saëns, that's maybe a little bit more conservative, I think that Dvorak will throw a little bit more of curveballs in there and will do something perhaps a little bit more unique, especially with the Czech and the Bohemian influence in this symphony in particular. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this symphony. Let's talk a little bit about some facts by Dvorak. Began playing violin at age 6. That's pretty impressive.
Well, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of composers and musicians in general that start at age 6 or around there.
Yeah.
It's really surprising.
Between ages 4 and 6, these composers are just firing on all cylinders, I guess.
But then there are some that don't do music until much later. But anyways, that's a little bit of a tangent.
And just like we just talked about, he's compared to Brahms by a lot of scholars and critics during his life. I could not see their music as more separate, in my mind, at least. They're definitely two very different composers.
Yeah, that's a really strange comparison. I don't really see the comparison there, even though I said Dvorak was a little conservative before. He's definitely a very different composer in the way that he treats the melody, usually, and even the harmonies as well. Like, yeah, I don't see the comparison to Brahms there.
Yes, yeah, definitely in comparison to Brahms, I find that a little bit strange. So Dvorak, like we've said, is a native of the Czech Republic. He applied a lot of the local music into a lot of his orchestral music in particular. You hear that in this piece and his Slavonic dances pretty frequently. He spent most of his summers composing in the Czech Republic in his little cottage he had, but then he was actually traveling pretty extensively throughout his years, not during the summer, so Prague and New York and Vienna and Britain. His famous travels to the U.S., he's actually director of the National Conservatory of Music in New York City for 3 years. And during this time, he discovers American folk music and orchestral music, and he writes his most famous symphony, his Ninth Symphony, from the New World. So that's a little bit of background on Antonín Dvořák. And yeah, that's a composer that ranks really highly for me, and I'm very, very passionate about. So I could talk about him all night. Let's move on to our next composer on this list, and this is one that Fernando and I ranked pretty closely. This is Felix Mendelssohn, 38 on my list, 42 on Fernando's.
Yeah, a German Romantic composer here. Lived from 1809 to 1847, so relatively early in the Romantic period. And that definitely shows in his music. He has a lot of chamber music, which is really interesting. And he was also quite the champion of Bach, pretty much the reason why we are so familiar with Bach nowadays. But anyways, the reason why I like Mendelssohn is because his music is so very melodic and tuneful, and it has that clear structure and form that is just a remnant of the classical period in a way.
Right.
But it can be very enjoyable. You know, sometimes you need the structure to really appreciate some of the music and the way that it's organized. And I mean, that's just what I like about music sometimes. Sometimes I like absolute chaos. I mean,
yeah.
I don't listen to as much chamber music, so that's why he's a little bit lower on my list than some of the other people. Yeah, those are some of the reasons why I like him and why he kind of falls just a little bit lower in the 40s for me.
It's interesting because the last composer on our last episode of Top 100 Composers was Camille Saint-Saëns.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Antonín Dvořák and we have Felix Mendelssohn here. And those are three composers ranked pretty closely that are a little bit more on the conservative side of Romanticism. I find that interesting.
Yeah, I think we got some of the more romantic composers out of the way pretty early.
Right, yeah. Besides some of the more underrated ones.
Mm-hmm.
But while he's on the more conservative side of Romanticism, I would say that Mendelssohn is a pretty unique composer of his time, with 13 symphonies actually written solely for strings, and then 5 for the full orchestra. And those 5 are the ones that I'm most familiar with. I'm not really familiar with those 13 others, but found that to be an interesting fact about Mendelssohn. And for me, specifically, his 3rd symphony, the Scottish Symphony, and the Italian, and his 5th symphony, the Reformation, are the ones that find themselves in my rotation very often. And then Midsummer's Night's Dream, as well as Hebrides and Fingal's Cave, are also really worth checking out from Mendelssohn. And we're actually going to take a listen to his 3rd symphony today, the 4th movement. This is one that Fernando and I probably talk about weekly, so this is one that we're really passionate about. Let's take a listen. Thank you.
That was the fourth movement of Mendelssohn's Third Symphony. This is the Allegro Vivacissimo movement. And this one is just so exciting, and I just love watching the video where Dudamel rehearses this movement specifically. It's so great. It's energetic. It's lively. I mean, as the tempo indication would tell you, it is really lively and fun, energetic. It just, I don't know, there's something about it that excites me in a way. But this is a symphony, and we were talking a little bit about his chamber music. Obviously, with the symphony being bigger and what we're more used to listening to, I think we just can't not mention that Mendelssohn has so much chamber music, and right. We just think it's so funny that we don't listen to that much chamber music.
I feel like the chamber music really just doesn't come up in our rotations that often.
Right, yeah. What we mean by chamber music, too, Mendelssohn has plenty of piano trios, and he has some string quartets and other things that are smaller ensembles than a full orchestra.
Right.
And so we listen to a lot of full orchestra music. So
and
maybe
a lot of symphonies in particular.
Yeah. So maybe if you'd like to join us in listening to some more chamber music, I think that will also be in my rotation for this week, along with the Dvorak.
Yeah, and I mean, the fact that he wrote so much string chamber music is exciting, because this string part in this excerpt that we just played is some of the finest orchestration that I've heard for a string section ever. I don't know if it's just because we watched that Dudamel video over and over, but there is something about the orchestration here that just really gets me excited and just so pleasing to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So funny thing here is Mendelssohn symphonies were not written in the order that they're indicated. They were actually written in the order of 1, 5, 4, 2, and his final one was 3, the one we just listened to.
And that makes so much sense, right? I mean, it is very mature writing.
Right.
And so it's so obvious that this would be the last one. I mean, not obvious, but it makes sense. It's logical.
Yeah. I think that there's a reason why this one is programmed so often. This one and the Italian Symphony in particular are programmed so often, but this one has taken up a notoriety of its own a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just in our world, because we listen to this one so much. So Mendelssohn's musical legacy is still, though, regarded as quite conservative amongst the other romantic composers of the time, in comparison to Franz Liszt, Richard Wagner, and Hector Berlioz, which you don't get much more outlandish for the time than those three. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and I would completely agree with that. I mean, especially with him writing so much chamber music, something that a lot of classical composers were doing more so out of necessity, really.
Right.
Because they had to work for the court in such whereas Mendelssohn would probably not have been doing as much of that.
Right.
But yeah, he, yeah, it is conservative compared to Liszt and Wagner and Berlioz, but I think it is actually a little progressive for at least the people that he was hanging around with, you
right.
know, Brahms and Schumann and the others like that. Because especially in this symphony, the third symphony is nicknamed Scottish, and I can just picture the lush fields of grass
right.
Towards the end with the horns, when they have this really just beautiful passage at the end of this fourth movement. So I think it still kind of does achieve that more progressive goal of being programmatic, and it isn't just about the music, and it isn't absolute music in that way that some of the other composers of the time were doing.
Right, and you got to think that his love of J.S. Bach and C.P.E. Bach had something to do with that. I think that that was certainly an influence there. Considering his time period and the composers that's surrounding him is important when thinking about this music, and I do think that it stands out as being unique amongst those composers. Well, I think that's enough on Mendelssohn. We're coming up on another big gap here. So this is composer number 34, Darius Milhaud, and ranked number 8 on Fernando's list, and the completely incorrect ranking on my list of number 72. This is a composer, a French composer of the 20th century, that, goodness, if I could redo this list right now, I would rank him so much higher. I think that his 12 symphonies are just so unique, and his works for ballet and wind band definitely earn him a higher spot on the list. But at the time of making this list, Fernando had not yet introduced me to this composer, because this is one of his favorites, and then I saw that it was ranked so high, and I was like, wow, I really gotta check this out, because of course I trust your musical opinion in that sense.
Right.
And he just has this massive backlog of works and orchestral works and opera. Goodness, I'm so excited to find the time to be able to go through the rest of this music. Because he has such a unique compositional voice, even amongst some of the greats of the 20th century and the Romantic period.
Yeah, for me, Milhaud is just a criminally underrated symphonist. Like you said, he has so many symphonies, and they are all phenomenal. He uses really tasteful harmonies that would become the iconic French harmonies of that early 20th century period with some relatively later 20th century melodies. He really did a lot, I think, to further French music, and that was along with the rest of Lesis. And he provided this transition from impressionistic Ravel and Debussy to the extremes of Messiaen. Like, there's no getting to these later 20th century composers in France and today's composers without Milhaud, for me.
Absolutely. And you gotta think that even before that, the influences of maybe Franck or Lalo kind of leading up to this kind of culminated in Milhaud's music quite a bit, and a lot of elements from those two composers ended up kind of culminating into Milhaud. I don't really know what the relation is there, besides of course being in the same country, but I think that there was some of that. We listened to Franck on the podcast last week, and I could definitely hear some of that creeping into his music.
Yeah.
So we actually don't have any listening for Milhaud today. His dates are 1892 to 1974, so a little bit out of the public domain in terms of recordings that we could find for you. So unfortunately, we can't show you how great his music is, but like we've said, those symphonies, so underrated.
Listen to any of them.
Yeah. On all 12 of those symphonies, they're so unique. Get to work. They are absolutely great. Milhaud actually starts as a violinist and then becomes a composer. We talked about this earlier, how interesting his the 3 years that he spent in Brazil had influence on some of his works. I found that to be interesting.
Yeah, I think he does have a little bit of a groove to a lot of his works, especially after that Brazilian period.
Right. So yeah, we definitely found that interesting. So he comes to the U.S. during the Nazi invasion on France in World War II, as a lot of composers and people did. And he's influenced from this eclectic mix of composers from Arnold Schoenberg to Dave Brubeck. So if that tells you anything about his symphonies, is that not only do you have this crazy great French influence, you have Schoenberg and Dave Brubeck, and you're just like, whoa, what is this combination here? It's so unique and so cool.
Right, exactly. And if you're not intrigued by the idea of a combination of 12-tone and mixed meter and jazz,
yeah,
I mean, I don't know what to tell you. That, for me, that's something that is very intriguing. That's why Mio is so high on my list.
Yeah, it's just a dream of a composer, honestly. And if you ever are worried about running out of stuff to listen to, don't worry. He has a huge catalog of works. His opus numbers go all the way up to 443. So you've got a lot to catch up on. Those 12 symphonies, great place to start. And some of those wind band works are really, really cool too, and those ballets. So a lot of places to start with Mio.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on to our next composer, number 35, John Adams. The composer, not the president. He was number 40 on my list and 41 on Alex's list. So pretty close there. Funny how that got really close.
Yeah, I think that's been our closest thus far.
Yeah. Adams is a modern minimalist American composer. He was born in 1947 and is still around today. For me, I think he just has a really interesting approach to modern American music, incorporating that minimalism and jazz into one art form and one type of music that usually is really rhythmically interesting.
Yeah, rhythmically interesting and challenging. Chairman Dances, Harmonium, Lollapalooza, Nixon in China, Dr. Atomic, Shaker Loops, and A Short Ride in a Fast Machine are all known for being some of the cornerstone works of the modern American classical music. And these are not ones that really come up in my rotation that often, but when they do, I'm always finding myself really enjoying these works. I just think that John Adams has such a unique voice, and it's great that he's written so much music and is still writing music today. It's such a gift.
Yeah, and it's, like I said before, I really do think it's a different approach than a lot of other composers are taking.
Absolutely.
Today and before, of course. It is the perfect mix of minimalism and other genres,
right?
That it doesn't get boring, it doesn't get too repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something interesting coming or Absolutely. Happening, and I think that's why I enjoy his music so much.
And it has so much influence on a lot of other modern American composers, especially because I feel like a lot of the music that we end up playing in wind band or in orchestra is influenced in some way, particularly rhythmically, because I think that the rhythmic elements of John Adams' work tend to be borrowed upon a lot. There's usually the certain rhythmic drive, whether it's the ostinato or the melody just happens to be really, really melodic, that the main motif, Short Ride and Fast Machine, is a great example for that. So any of these works that we listed, I think that Lollapalooza and Short Ride and Fast Machine and Shaker Loops and Chairman Dances are probably really good places to start with John Adams. Fun facts about John Adams: he actually met Duke Ellington growing up and is a clarinet player. So those two things, I think, further coalesce into this identity that is John Adams. I really did not peg him to be a clarinet player, but the more I think about it, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. I can definitely see it with some of the more repetitive lines.
Right.
I think some of those can be very challenging on different instruments. But I think he was able to figure it out, and especially utilize the clarinet really well in a lot of his works. That's
Absolutely.
Something that I hadn't thought about before. So,
but yeah, the more you think about it, those clarinet uses is great. And then the Duke Ellington, meeting him when he was growing up, that had to be huge, especially for how much jazz influence is in quite a bit of his work. So
right.
Interesting there. He studied with Leon Kirchner, Roger Sessions, Earl Kim, and David Del Tredici. So, great list of teachers there. And he actually won a Pulitzer Prize for his piece On the Transmigration of Souls. So definitely a very accomplished composer, and he's very well recognized by the American and the worldwide orchestral community.
Right.
Well, that's enough on John Adams for today. We don't have any listening for you because he is a much more modern composer, so we don't have public domain music that we can show you for him. So next, we're going to move on to number 36. This is Ottorino Respighi, ranked number 20 on my list and 63 on Fernando's. He's a early 20th century Italian composer, born in 1879, but a lot of his works were written into the 20th century, and his most well-known works, I would say, are a little bit more of that modern flair, but the basis is kind of in this, a little bit more of what Rimsky-Korsakov was doing. And fun fact, he actually studied with Rimsky-Korsakov. So that's something to note there. Fountains of Rome, Pines of Rome, Roman festivals are obvious choices for this well-known Italian composer. But Respighi has this massive catalog of works that I'm still discovering and enjoying, including his work for orchestra The Birds and Rossiniana, which is a work based on some piano works by Rossini. So there's a lot to dive into with Respighi, and for those three pieces alone, I would put him at number 20, but I keep finding new stuff in my listening that I'm really enjoying by Respighi.
Yeah, there's so much by Respighi that I'm not familiar with either. And so it's another one that we're just I'm just going to have to dive into a little bit more. But from what I know of Respighi and, you know, the things that all the pieces that you listed, those are all the things that got him on my list in the first place and have him at number 63. The thing that I appreciate about those works is that they have this really unique orchestration that only Respighi has, and it makes his music sound very unique, and it has this character to it that, I don't know, it's the use of the strings and the brass and the woodwinds that is unusual for the time.
Right.
And even today, I mean, I think I could peg a Respighi work out
right
from some other ones.
Well, maybe that's one I'll do for Guess That Lick.
Right, well, we'll see if I would get that, but what I really think is interesting is that Respighi had this really strong interest in 16th to 18th century music.
Right.
So kind of Renaissance to late Baroque and really early classical music. And so, you know, I think that's so apparent in his music. It's so easy to see that he had this really strong interest in earlier music.
Right.
Because, and that's kind of what brings it down a little bit for me, just because it's not my preference, right?
Right.
I usually am leaning a little bit farther forward in time. I do still love a lot of earlier music, but sometimes it just it doesn't do it for me every time.
Doesn't scratch that itch.
Right, exactly. So, but I do still love Respighi, and I think that his music is great. I think the early music influences also help to make it unique, and the combination of that with the orchestration is what makes it so interesting, and what keeps it really fresh for me, and why I would come back to his music pretty frequently. I mean, at least every couple months, maybe every couple weeks. I do like Respighi a lot, and I think that all those works that you mentioned are great places to start. Pines of Rome is definitely one that a lot of people are familiar with, probably from Fantasia.
So. Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the most commonly performed works, even just in those Fantasia concerts alone. So today we're actually going to be listening to something that definitely has a little bit of that early music influence. This is Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances, the third movement, Villanelle. Let's take a listen. That was Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances, the third movement, Villanella. What a gorgeous work with the instrumentation here. It starts off quite early music sounding, quite Renaissance sounding, and then it takes a turn about a minute and 20 seconds in, and you're just like, oh, okay, so this is Respighi. This is being written in the early 20th century. So it just goes to show you the variety that you have going on in the 20th century.
Right, exactly. And the biggest thing that sounds like just earlier periods of music is the texture, right? There's this harp accompaniment, and then the melody is just there. It's monophonic, right? Is that the right word for it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it just has a very early music texture. Not early music, but Renaissance, Baroque texture.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely borrows from both of those traditions pretty frequently. So, a couple fun facts about Respighi. He's composer, violinist, educator. He briefly studies with Rimsky-Korsakov at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, so you can definitely hear that in a lot of his music. He's actually another composer with a relationship with Sergei Diaghilev, who is known for his famous collaborations with Stravinsky in particular. He orchestrated some of Rossini's piano music for a ballet that Diaghilev was doing, so I thought that was an interesting fact. Respighi had his Fountains of Rome actually conducted by Toscanini, which kind of led to the work's popularization and his own popularization a little bit. So definitely worth noting there. I just find it interesting, the intersection between a lot of these famous figures in music.
Right, and it's sometimes you wouldn't peg Respighi for this time, right?
No.
For this time in music. Personally, I never even thought of Respighi and Toscanini living in the same time period, and even Rossini. It just doesn't feel like they lived in the same time, you know, based on their music or based on, for Toscanini, their conducting career. It's funny how that works, and I'm glad we're able to clarify that in these types of episodes.
Yeah, so we get a little bit more of a clear picture of what's going on in music history here. Yeah, and I think that overall, when we're talking about Respighi's work, it's all about that orchestration. And we hope that you heard some of that great orchestration in that excerpt here today. But definitely check out his Fountains of Rome and Pines of Rome, and his Roman Festivals is my favorite out of the three, so check those out. They're very, very fun works. All right, well, with that, let's go ahead and move on to a composer near and dear to Fernando's heart. This is Aram Khachaturian.
Khachaturian was a Soviet Armenian composer of the 20th century, lived from 1903 to 1978. For me, Khachaturian has this very distinct style that has a really healthy mix of chromatic harmonies with melodic writing. He's an important voice for Armenian music as well. A lot of people lump him in with some of the Russian composers because it was Soviet. Armenia was part of the Soviet Union, but that area still has a very unique culture of music, and it has its own folk music and things of the sort. Khachaturian is mostly known for his dance music or his ballet music. A lot of people are familiar probably with Saber Dance, as well as some of his ballet suites. Alex, what are the things that you like about Khachaturian's music?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Khachaturian. He is ranked a little bit lower on my list. He's number 61 on mine and 36 on Fernando's. But Khachaturian is one that I do find myself coming back to fairly often. The music from Spartacus is particularly iconic, and his really, really underrated three symphonies that have great use of organ and brass and are really quite challenging. You don't get to hear those performed all too often.
Yeah, and I love that you brought up the symphonies because I can't think of anybody that really knows too much about them.
Exactly. Right?
Everybody is familiar with his dance and ballet music, and it's great in its own right, but his symphonies are really interesting and different than a lot of other people's symphonies. And like I said, it brings this really unique voice to Armenia in the form of symphonic writing.
Right, and that kind of brings us to the most important point about Aram Khachaturian, is that he holds the distinction of a lot of Armenian firsts. He wrote the first Armenian symphony, the first ballet, the first concerto, first film score. He is a big deal, and yet nobody is talking about this composer, so we wanted to shed some light on Khachaturian because he is an important composer for the country and to us. We really, really love this composer and want to spread the word. So he has this really unique combination of Armenian folk influence and then the Russian classical music tradition, maybe of Tchaikovsky, Alexander Borodin, and Rimsky-Korsakov. And it's so interesting to us that he is historically seen by musicologists as a contemporary of Shostakovich and Prokofiev, and we agree that he definitely deserves that spot with the three of them, but he's by far the most underrated of the three and the least talked about.
Right, exactly. It's a great point. I mean, his music is comparable to Shostakovich and Prokofiev's, but it's, yeah, it is something something that you don't see too often. I mean, you don't hear too often.
Yeah, completely unique music, and we wish we had listening for you today. Unfortunately, he also kind of lies out of the realm of public domain with most of his works, so we don't have any listening for you today. Start with those three symphonies, though. Very, very underrated, and really, really great use of brass in particular.
All right, with that being said, let's go ahead and move on to number 38 on the list, Lajos Janacek, number 44 on Alex's list and number 57 on mine. He was a late Romantic, early 20th century Czech composer, another Czech composer here alongside Dvorak on this list. He lived from 1854 to 1928.
Yeah, it's interesting because I labeled him as late Romantic and early 20th century because I think that a lot of his music kind of pushes the bounds of what the Romantic period is, and you start to see that a little bit towards the end of the Romantic period, but Janacek is one that I think that also gets overlooked, not dissimilarly to Khachaturian that we just mentioned. This is a composer I just don't find myself listening to nearly enough, though. His works are great. He has such a cool compositional voice, and especially on this list, because he's one of the few Czech composers on the list, along with Dvorak. I love his Taras Bulba, Lacan Dances, his Sinfonietta, Fairy Tale, Glagolitic Mass, and his string quartets are all really, really unique. And I haven't even begun to dive deep enough into the rest of his works. And it just excites me that these works are so bold and different that there's still way more for me to discover with this.
Right. And I think that Janacek just fits into that turn of the century period that right. I like to consider
like
in music history. Right.
Yeah.
He has, he's pushing the boundaries a little bit. And that's kind of the period that I really love in music when they're really experimental and trying to do something different. But you can still tell that he is very much inspired by Dvorak and Slavic folk music. He built upon these influences to create something that's much more contemporary. And it's something that I really enjoy listening to. Also, I don't listen to it nearly as much as I should.
Right.
So I'm excited to listen to it. We actually do have listening for Janacek. We have his Sinfonietta, Movement 4, the Allegretto. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
was Janáček's Sinfonietta, the fourth movement, Allegretto. What a wacky ending to that excerpt. It's so cool. I find it so interesting that he is often lumped in with romantic composers, yet I think that this is, like you said, entirely its own thing, this turn of the century category.
Right, and I think that he's just starting to get experimental, like a lot of other composers were at the time. And I really enjoyed that. Maybe Janáček will have to move up on my list.
Yeah, and I think that's also one of the most modern things we've listened to on the show. Just the most modern sounding. And so maybe something a little bit different for you guys at home or on your way to work. So interesting sounds we've got going on today. So, some facts about Janáček. He's a composer, musicologist, theory enthusiast, and educator. Theory enthusiast makes sense there.
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
And the musicology background here is especially apparent as well. He's also a skilled pianist and organist. He studied at the Leipzig Conservatory. Pretty legit there. Influenced greatly by the works of Smetana and Dvorak. Makes sense there. And then he's really just so well known for his originality and experimental use of harmony, and I think that comes from his interest in folk music, partially, because some folk music can evolve over time to be something different harmonically than it was originally intended to be, and as a result, we get folk music that is not entirely tonal in the sense that we know it, and then it allows you to elaborate on this and become something completely different and not so programmatic or romantic sounding.
Yeah, and that's such a great point. And I think also it's just that folk music also from that area or from different parts of the world sounds different, right?
Yeah.
They have different harmonies that are traditional to that area and culturally significant in that way. And
absolutely.
I think that it's sometimes jarring to the Western ear, right? To the, farther West European ear, right?
Yeah, I could totally get behind that. It's just a different kind of sound in really every country for their folk music. Some are more influenced by others than most, but I think generally, the country that Janáček is from is definitely a unique sound in comparison to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of unique sounds, let's move on to number 39. This is Gioachino Rossini. This is number 46 on my list, 55 on Fernando's, 39 overall. The famous Italian Romantic composer. And the reason I say unique sounds is not unique in the sense that Janáček is unique for something more contemporary. I think that he's unique for Rossini is unique for his great use of melody, similar to Bizet.
Right.
Just such catchy melodies and some of the most cherished melodies of all time. And one of the most heavily featured Italian composers of all time, William Tell, the Barber of Seville, and his sinfonias, which are a little bit underrated, they find themselves in my rotation fairly frequently, and I just feel like this list wouldn't be complete without him.
Right, they would not be, and for me, it's all about the operas with Rossini, and they just have the catchiest themes.
Absolutely.
And that's why they're used in Looney Tunes, right? That's
yeah.
why people know them.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they just get stuck in your head. They just get stuck in
Earworms.
Your ear. Yeah. And it's always a battle to not whistle or hum along to maybe the Barber of Seville or something like that. And speaking of the Barber of Seville, we actually have a listening excerpt from it, from the overture of the Barber of Seville. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Rossini's Barber of Seville Overture. What a great and catchy tune. A collection of a bunch of really catchy tunes here. And I feel like that it's just this timelessness, and that sounds cliche to say, but there's a certain timelessness to these melodies and this orchestration that just lends itself to the ear so well, and I just don't ever find myself getting sick of.
Yeah, and it's sophisticated yet fun.
Right.
Right. And that's why it works so well for Looney Tunes, I guess. It has this really jovial feeling, but it can still be dramatic and serious. And it works perfectly for the opera.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so good.
It's funny because Rossini is actually said to have had great humor and wit. And he was very popular socially. He was a little bit of a celebrity, having written 39 operas, so that's I think that the important thing to focus on here is the humor and the funniness and the wit with Rossini, though. I think that that's especially apparent in his music.
Right, exactly. That's a great point. And of course, with 39 operas, you'd be pretty popular. So,
and he wrote nearly all of those in the course of 10 years.
That's so impressive.
What have I been doing the last 10 years? Like, we started a podcast.
Well, yeah, I guess that's something.
So it's funny because though he's regarded as a famous Italian, a lot of musicologists actually cite his music as being a little bit more of a French influence, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can entirely put my finger on that.
That is really interesting. And I guess it's tough to really nail down for me, because I see Rossini's music as very Italian, and
yeah,
that's kind of my a bit of my indicator for Italian music. But I think it could also be just because of the popularity of French music at the
right
time. That was kind of booming at the time, and so of course, why wouldn't you take from the more popular the more popular music at the time. I mean, right. They do it today all the time, so.
And I think there is that bit of an intersection between the French and the Italian cultures in music. I mean, you have Bizet coming over to Italy and being inspired by the music of Rossini. And then I'm sure the other way around probably occurred fairly often.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, I mean, why wouldn't it happen, right? And that's what we're doing even now. We're saying, we love this music, we're sharing this music, so somebody's bound to be inspired and write right. a similar melody to Rossini or
yeah, some other perhaps composer. In the realm of French Grand Opera as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a definite possibility. I mean, they were over the top, and it seems like Rossini was a little bit over the top as well.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit in that sense, but we still see Rossini as very much the quintessential Italian composer. So definitely worth checking out some more of Rossini's music. Now, we're going to move on to our final composer, who we unfortunately don't have any listening for you today. This is actually only the third wind band composer that we've had on this list, at least primarily wind band composer as we know him. This is number 40, Carter Pan, who ranked number 51 on both of our lists. And this is a composer, a modern American composer born in 1972 that we really, really love and just identify with his music on such a deep level. I think that his Serenade for Winds is actually one of my most listened to works of 2019. Definitely my most listened to wind band work. I think that it's so varied in its harmonic language and its influences, and it's so heart-wrenchingly beautiful. I love it so much. That was one of my first wind band scores that I purchased to myself, so definitely will always hold a special place in my heart.
Well, speaking of scores, I happen to love Carter Pan's detailed notation, the level of detail in the in the notation, in the score. I really appreciate it. That's something that I tend to look at. You know, it's not a deal breaker, but it's something that I like to see, because it's so much easier to perform the music when you have clear directions.
Absolutely. So, Professor Pan, if you're listening, thank you so much. We really love your music and the attention, the detail in your music. A couple other pieces that I really enjoy by him are his Slalom, Four Factories, and then My Brother's Brain. That's one that I need to send to you, Fernando. That's a really, really interesting one, and it's basically exploring, if I'm not mistaken, the relationship between him and his brother, not only growing up, but kind of throughout his life. And it's really, really quite a great piece, and very emotional and sincere, but also, like you said, very, very detailed and really, really meticulous in its construction.
Right.
So a couple more facts about Carter Pan, Professor Pan. He is actually currently a professor of music at University of Colorado at Boulder. We don't have any relationship to him. I'm calling him Professor Pan because that's what I would call him in real life. But he's a composer and a pianist. He's had premieres all around the world. London, Moscow, New York, Chicago. He's had some Grammy nominations. He's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Just a really, really great modern composer. And I wish we could play some music, but we would have to get some more permission for that. But we're really huge fans of Professor Pan's music, for sure.
Absolutely. An exciting composer that is still composing and is only on the rise. So
yeah, he has some new works that he's written in the last 2 years that I definitely want to check out that I haven't had the chance to yet. But he's one I always will watch and check out his works. And his works come in my rotation so frequently, probably even more so than some of the composers ranked above him, in air quotes, because you can't rank these composers. I mean, when I listen to his Serenade for Winds, it becomes my favorite piece.
Right.
So I'm just transported into this magical world of whatever composer's music I'm listening to at the time. And that's the exciting thing for us about
this list is that we just get to really go through and unpack what we love about music. So ranking one composer over another is not diminishing at all. The purpose of this list is to expose you to more music and to more composers. It is not to rank one above another. It's to expose you, the audience, about the joys of music, and for us to be able to express that love for music through the podcast, because that's one of our big goals.
Right. And it's all just generally what we like to listen to day to day on average.
Yeah.
But like Alex said, it changes every day, sometimes within the hour, sometimes within the minute. So
this week, I'm like, my favorite composer is Ray Vaughan Williams. I've got a new CD with Leonard Slatkin's recordings of all 9 of his symphonies and Fantasia on the theme by Thomas Tallis. And I told Fernando before this, I'm just like, Vaughan Williams is my favorite composer this week.
Right. And it's, and he was lower than that on the average list. So,
right.
it changes all the time. It's an arbitrary ranking, but just for fun and for, for discussion, really.
Right. Yeah. We really, really love talking about this, and we hope that you guys get something out of it too. Sometimes we'll talk for hours and hours about this stuff. So we hope that you guys have enjoyed this and have listened to some good music. And don't forget about those Mio symphonies or those Cacciatorean symphonies, because those are all the works that we recommended today that we didn't get to listen to. Please take a listen to those. That's part of the point of why we talk about them. So,
right, take a listen to those works, and let us know what you think.
Yeah, because we want to nerd out with you guys. So check us out on social media. Send us an email. You'll hear all that information here in the outro in a minute. But I think we're getting pretty close to wrapping up here. This has been another fun edition of Top 100 Composers.
Right, another really fun one. It's always nice to talk about some artists and musicians and composers that we just really enjoy listening to. It's been another great one. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.